Our prom crash. Before our prom crash was written into history, signs, portents of summer, had begun to appear in the windows of the subway, Burger King, McDonald's, KFC, and Taco Bell restaurants near the freeway off-ramp at Constitution Circle, each announcing that the establishment in question was hiring part and full-time employees. Before our prom crash, people had begun to make their plans as the tight regimentation of the school term began to slacken. They would be spending their delirious leisure time delivering pizzas, or mixing paint at the House and Garden Center, or cutting grass, or traveling to the mountains, to the sea, to foreign capitals, or counseling sleepaway campers, or babysitting, or in one chilling instance, news of which we reacted to as if the girl had announced her intention to ferry across the Styx in the company of Sharon, the coal-eyed boatman, driving into the city with her father each day to answer phones at his law office. People dreamed of college, of freedom, of sex, of love, of clothes and cars. Before our prom crash, some of us were avoiding the prom ostentatiously in an effort to inscribe ourselves upon the event more deeply than if we had attended, to form the makings of a juvenile legend, the anti-prom, that would have, we were convinced, prevailed in the memory of the community had our prom crash not occurred. Instead, because of our prom crash, we'd spent the ensuing years wishing we'd been there, wishing we'd seen those lost boys and girls on the dance floor, seated happily like imitation adults around the tables, smoking in the parking lot, although we had, in fact, seen them all so many times before. On the day before our prom crash, Mr. Jacobs, science, Mr. Markovich, Spanish, Mr. Dubno, English, Miss DiGiovanni, math, and Mrs. Bauman, social studies, had each been heard to say, over the ringing of the bell signaling the change of periods, "Just because it's prom weekend doesn't mean that you're excused from completing your homework," or words to that effect. Dubno and DiGiovanni were said to have added an admonition to the students that they should behave responsibly and drive carefully. On the day before our prom crash, Chief Zerker had assembled all 40 members of the city police force to brief them on his plan to institute checkpoints, beefed up patrols, and plentiful overtime over the weekend. Chief Zerker also paid a personal visit to the residence of Jordan and Jacob Alderson, twin boys whose single parent was in the habit of absenting herself from the home, and whose record of their multiple encounters with law enforcement had been multiply expunged by judges of the juvenile court, in order to warn them, in not inaccurate anticipation of their unwholesome intentions, against hosting a party or gathering of any kind. On the day before our prom crash, Marguerite Solis broke up with Matt Fossbenner, tactlessly, it was generally agreed, in the parking lot behind the school while her new boyfriend, James Pardee, waited in his 85 Jetta, gunning the engine. On the day before our prom crash, Rajiv Suresh received the surprising but welcome news that his waitlisted application for admission to the California Institute of Technology had been accepted, and, although he did not have a date, he immediately changed his plans for the evening in order to attend the prom. On the morning of our prom crash, 16 boys and 4 girls were known to have taken their own or their parents' cars to be washed and detailed at establishments on Broad, on 18th, on Camino Real. On the afternoon of our prom crash, rented black, white, and powder blue tuxedos were picked up at menswear stores in 3 different malls. On the afternoon of our prom crash, various girls, trying on their gowns, gauged the effectiveness of various punishing diets. On the afternoon of our prom crash, florist and county coroner Larry Menke and his 2 assistants prepared and boxed the last of the boutonnieres and orchid corsages they had ordered. On the afternoon of our prom crash, 7 different bands rehearsed original material in garages and basements. 31 different boys at such rehearsals complained about the sellout band that had been hired to perform and its repertory of cover songs. On the afternoon of our prom crash, supplies of beer, spirits, marijuana, quaaludes, cocaine, mushrooms, ecstasy, GHB, OxyContin, methamphetamine, and other intoxicants had been laid in. On the evening of our prom crash, the members of the varsity football team appeared in the super-stretch limousine that they'd rented for themselves and their dates, and some of us stood dumbstruck at the edge of the grass, watching the enormous and vulgar vehicle pass through the long shadows of the suburban twilight. Before our prom crash, parents and their daughters' dates sat in the living rooms or stood awkwardly in front hallways, making stilted conversation while awaiting the radiant appearance of the young women in their gowns at the top of the stairs, television playing low. True, one boy was asked to wait on the porch, and the front door was shut in his face, but another played one-on-one with his date's dad, the older man panting, the boy astonishing the girl's younger brothers, who watched as he made around-the-world layups in his tuxedo and patent leather shoes. Our prom crash, when it finally was time for it to occur, happened on a night when the star was dripping with stars, when the sky was dripping with stars, and hung with a thin crescent moon that shed no light on those dark back roads. The temperature was a balmy 67 degrees. Our prom crash happened near Dusty Blossom Circle, near Grandview Glen, near Burning Bridge Hollow, near Indian Cloud Run, near Harvest Beaver Flats, near Blue Feather Ridge, near Gentle Shadow Haven, near Sleepy Willow Pike, near Silver Zephyr Drive. The country club was nearby, the dump, the old apple orchard, trees leaning crooked and dark against the lighter darkness of the sky. The road curved sharply there. It was wet, visibility was low. The community had lobbied the county for years for a stop sign, for a traffic signal, for a paved shoulder, for the filling in of the disused culvert running alongside the roadbed. The night of our prom crash, questions were raised immediately about the condition of the brakes on what came to be known as the death car. Certain facts came to light about the specific physical circumstances surrounding the causes of the crash and the means of death achieved by the victims. In some respects, the death car was well maintained. In some respects, the death car was badly maintained. The death car had perhaps been illegally altered. The death car would be put on a flatbed and sent on a tour of high schools around the state by the Department of Public Safety. The victims had died instantly, or in agony. They had died of blunt trauma, of massive intrathoracic hemorrhage, of pons and brainstem laceration, of subdural hematoma, of aorta laceration, of basal or skull fracture, of blunt trauma to the neck with asphyxia. They had, in their turn, been oblivious, fearful, and regretful. Defeating the expectations of some, both the football team and the Aldersons were not involved in our prom crash, robbing us of the opportunity for bathos. Neither Matt nor Marguerite and James were involved. In a repudiation of irony, no upright citizen, no tipsy councilman, no off-duty police officer was involved. When our prom crash occurred, we heard about it while sitting in the executive diner off Route 9A. We heard about it on the radio. We heard about it when Mark Victor ran into the diner and yelled out the news, his eyes wide and wild. We heard about it when we got home and were greeted by our parents, sober and concerned and dressed in their bathrobes, the Mr. Coffee spitting and gurgling in the bright light of the kitchen on the counter beneath the greasy electric clock. We heard about it the next day. We heard about it within minutes of its happening. We heard about it because we were in the vehicle following the doomed car, both of us speeding through the night to get to the ardent darkness of the municipal golf course. We heard about it when the extension we'd wired next to our beds rang, listened unbelievingly to the news, even as our parents groaned through the walls about the lateness of the hour, and why are your friends calling you now? Can't you wait to talk to them tomorrow? We heard about it while sipping Southern Comfort on the retaining wall. We heard about it under the lights in the 7-Eleven lot. We heard about it while our hands felt around in each other's underwear. We made a stupid joke. We cried. We went home. We took the opportunity to get wasted. We sank into a sitting position. We fainted. We asked for inappropriately lurid details. We got excited. We called our girlfriends and, becoming annoyed when they didn't answer, promptly forgot about our prom crash. After our prom crash, somebody said that the insurance adjuster he'd seen at the wrecker's yard taking Polaroid pictures of the death car was a guy who'd played tight end for the West High back when. After our prom crash, Larry Menke was seen lost in thought behind the counter of his shop, and some claimed that his flowers weren't as fresh as they once had been. After our prom crash, the mayor grew more distracted, according to sources close to the administration, and withdrew from the upcoming election, citing a seemingly abrupt desire to, quote, spend more time with my family, unquote. After our prom crash, a surveyor was seen by several motorists as he stood making notes on the side of the road near the site of our prom crash, his level mounted on a tripod, his county pickup parked some distance away. These circumstances seem irrefutably connected to our prom crash. More questions arose, consequent to our prom crash. Questions not subject to thorough and public debate. Did Matt Fassbender actually confess to us that he wished that Marguerite and James had been the ones to die in our prom crash? Did that allow us to consider for the first time the possibility that our prom crash may have been secretly viewed by some as a fatal occasion of providence? Regardless, did we necessarily like the boys and girls who died in our prom crash? Were their funerals well attended? Overflowing with mourners, as the local newspaper had it. Were they coordinated by the funeral directors at the three funeral homes in our town so that they did not overlap? Did Larry Menke have to refer some orders to other florists in the area? Did the local clergy feel overwhelmed? Was one of the victims Jewish, requiring many of us to don the unfamiliar yarmulke for the services? Which verses from which books of the Bible were read at these funerals? From Psalms? From Ecclesiastes? From 1 Corinthians? From John? Did any of us wish that we ourselves had died in our prom crash, each indulging the familiar fantasy of being a witness to his or her own funeral? Did we feel a guilty thrill that our prom crash, being ours, marked this particular instance of an annual event, stultifying, yet as fervently as anticipated as Christmas, as different, tragic, memorable? Did Principal Durkin assemble the student body in the auditorium to deliver a sorrowful but uplifting memorial to our last lost classmates, their graduation photos enlarged and mounted on tripods placed on the stage? Were some people awakened by recurring nightmares? Did the best friend of one of the victims start to take long and lonely walks in the fields behind the IBM facility? Did anyone fall into unwanted drug or alcohol abuse? Did anyone suddenly discover himself sitting on the edge of his bed, one leg crossed over the other, one barefoot awaiting the sock dangling from one hand, lost in thought? Did we take solace in the sudden, militarily efficient appearance on campus of grief counselors whose designated job was to relentlessly aid and comfort us? Did we vie to speak to them? When we did we overstate our relationships with the dead? Were the offices of local psychotherapists generally housed in the parlor floors of old Victorian homes on the east side of Division, filled with new patients who, encountering one another in the waiting rooms, would silently nod hello? Did we all ask ourselves if we could count ourselves among the members of that coveted group, the survivors? Our prom crash led to the revelation of secret crushes, to unplanned pregnancies, to sudden changes in college plans, to hasty and ill-advised marriages, to second mortgages, to small business failure, to loss of religious faith. Men in conservatively cut suits were seen emerging from expensive sedans parked in the driveways of the victims' parents' houses, carrying briefcases. Then men in conservatively cut suits were seen emerging from less expensive sedans parked in the driveways of people unrelated to the victims. There was renewed resolve on the part of some to leave town and pursue faraway dreams, as well as an uptick in enrollment in the memoir writing class in the adult education program at the community college. Mail for the victims of our prom crash, from the colleges to which they'd been accepted, from the companies that had hired them as summer employees, from distant friends and acquaintances, continued to arrive with blameless insensitivity at their parents' homes. A futile petition was circulated throughout the town asking the state legislature to raise the legal drinking age to 21. Words and phrases that were often heard after our prom crash. Blood alcohol level. Charges and countercharges. Circling the wagons. Close-knit. Closure. Coming together. Crash site. Criminally negligent. Deadly crash. Depressed. Fatal crash. Fiery crash. Finger-pointing. God. God in his wisdom. God's mysterious ways. God's plan. Grief-stricken. Heartbreak. Hopes and dreams. Live on. Makeshift shrine. Memory. Modest, well-kept homes and manicured lawns. Nightmare. Ordinary. Outpouring of grief. Outpouring of sadness. Outpouring of sympathy. Popular and well-liked. puts everything in perspective. Quiet and studious, sad, sleepy, taken from us too soon. Their whole lives ahead of them. Tragedy, tragic, typical, vigil, waste, worst nightmare. More questions. After our prom crash, were the people who professed to have been completely unaffected by it actually unaffected? Were the people who professed to have been profoundly affected by it as profoundly affected as they claimed? Was there a moment of epiphany for some in which they realized that life goes on? Was there a moment of epiphany for others in which they realized that life can be taken from us at any moment? After our prom crash, James Hooton began to tell people, anyone who'd listen, as some would have it, that he'd been offered a ride in the death car and had turned it down. And did we look at him then as if he had the taint of death upon him or the taint of life? But on the day of our prom crash, what defined us? Was it the national and global events and trends that entered our awareness both consciously and unconsciously? Was it the cultural heritage, a version of whose various perfections was being passed on to us each day in the classroom that had been identified as particularly our own? Was it that familiar suburban myopia one hears about, the cinnamon toast crunch some ate for breakfast, the folded pile of freshly laundered clothes some found awaiting them on the single straight chair placed on the landing, the music some listened to in the car or while waiting at the bus stop? Was it the boredom of chemistry, of social studies, of trig, of English, of French, of phys ed, of chorus, of band, of drama, of musical theater, of art? Was it hiding our semen-encrusted socks from our mothers? Is it possible that one can be defined by a semen-encrusted sock on one day and by a tragic event that happens to somebody else on the next? Did such considerations in the aftermath of our prom crash cause us to reflect upon what some of us discerned in ourselves as a complete lack of a discrete identity? The dead were fixed in their photos after our prom crash. The yearbook became one of the prime relics of our prom crash. The least popular of the dead became famous, but even the most famous of the dead was merely, and always would be merely, dead. After our prom crash, did we recall Euripides' words, "The point of death is death, and the dead are lost and gone"? Would Mr. Dubnow have aided us in recalling these words after our prom crash? Would any of the clergy? Had any of the victims of our prom crash peaked, as is sometimes said of certain high schoolers? Did they have their entire lives in front of them, or were those lives, like everyone's, only behind them? Time has passed since our prom crash, enough time since our prom crash, for a composite and representative life to have formed from our aggregate achievements in and contributions to the world, sufficient and representative enough to endow or mock the dead with the ghostly shadow of what might have been. We have married and divorced. We have had our own children. We have earned undergraduate and graduate degrees. We have become rich. We have filed for bankruptcy. We have been arrested. We have been on television. We have gone into rehab. We have won prizes in the state lottery. We have opened our own businesses. We have filed lawsuits. We have been accused of sexual harassment. We have joined the armed forces. We have told off-color jokes. We've gotten drunk at weddings, we've feared for our lives, we've avoided paying income taxes, we've felt invincible, we've become famous, we've cheated and been cheated on, we've been treated for depression, for cancer, for heart disease, for hypertension, for insomnia, we have lost parents, we have renovated houses, we have traveled the world, we have learned yoga, we have become vegan, we have bought firearms and security systems, we have come out of the closet, we have settled for less, we have written letters to movie stars, we've been consumed with envy and delighted in schadenfreude, and we have dreamed entire days away. On the basis of this average, this mean, can we project the dead of our prom crash into a future in which they would, as we all do, discover their unrecognizable selves?